So as we start today's Political Rewind, could we all just take a moment? I know that after the Braves secured their place in the World Series, there was some politicizing of that when Republicans like Governor Kemp decided to use that moment to once again hit Democrats because the All-Star Game was moved out of Atlanta over Senate Bill 202. But could we just, for a moment, celebrate together? It's one of the great things about sports, isn't it? I mean, even in dark political times where this toxic kind of partisanship has driven us apart, I think everybody in Georgia is excited and thrilled that the Atlanta Braves have won the World Series. And I hope we can all just take a few minutes and celebrate a great, great victory and congratulate the Atlanta Braves for that win. And there's nobody happier about that this moment. I mean, I know there are an awful lot of Braves fans out there. You don't want to single anybody out. But Greg Bluestein, if you have to single somebody out, you'd be the guy.
I was supposed to be on a plane at this moment going to Houston for Game 7. Thankfully, I got a refund on those tickets and on my Game 7 tickets and all that. But it was quite the moment. And I had a surprisingly good time celebrating the victory, not at a sports bar, not at the stadium at Truist with thousands of others, but at Felicia Moore's election watching party where she finished her victory speech shortly before the bottom of the ninth inning.
You got a shout out in one of the most popular morning newsletters. Which one was it, Greg?
A Political Playbook. Tia Mitchell, yeah. My colleague in Washington, pointed that out this morning. They were
Political Playbook,
which of my celebration.
Well, we're very happy for you, Greg Bluestein, as I am for everybody else who's joining us for this show today. And we've got the perfect panel to talk about the results of the election, to talk about redistricting, which starts today at the Capitol. Andre Gillespie, you're a native of the state of Virginia, and so your insights about what happened in Virginia and what it may mean for the rest of the country and for Georgia in particular will be important. Andre Gillespie, professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnston Institute for the Study of Race and Difference. Welcome to Political Rewind today, Andre.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Donna Lowry, Donna, you're about to get into the midst of the redistricting session. You're already down at the state capitol as we present the show today. So thank you for being willing to take some time to join us. How are you feeling? Are you energized about the session that starts today?
I'm excited. I'm just exhausted because of the game. I had a hard time going to sleep. I was so excited about everything. So I'm thrilled. The good thing is knowing that everybody here is feeling the same way. Yeah, excited but tired.
Professor Karen Owen, professor of political science at the University of West Georgia, is with us as well today. How are you, Karen?
I'm doing well. My eyes are slowly adjusting to waking up and seeing light again after watching the television with the Braves and then my phone for all the election results.
Yeah. Karen, tell us, when I introduce you, I realize I don't also mention something that's part of your role out there at the university. You're oversee the Thomas B. Murphy. Tell us, what is that role exactly?
I'm the director of the Thomas Murphy Center for Public Service, and our center is to engage the students and community in more public service outreach and civic engagement.
Okay, I really should mention that when you do the show, so thank you for reminding me of it. All right, let's get right to it. Greg Bluestein, it's no surprise in the city of Atlanta that Felicia Moore has made the runoff. Everybody kind of expected that all along. She usually was topping the polls, which showed her with a slight lead. But your polling at the AJC typically showed that it looked like Kasim Reed was going to be in the runoff with her. It now appears, and for those who are listening to the show at 2 o'clock, remember we're live at 9 a.m. and there we may see some changes, although it's not expected. It looks, Greg Bluestein, like the runoff is going to be between Felicia Moore and Andre Dickens.
Yeah, this would be a stunning collapse for former Mayor Kasim Reed, because take away even the polls, right? The polls, including our poll that was conducted by UGA, showed Kasim Reed in that number two spot. But even taking away the polls, just based on name recognition, based on fundraising advantages, based on endorsements from civil rights leaders to you know, younger up-and-coming politicians here in Atlanta, based on all of that, you know, you would have expected Kasim Reed to be right there in the thick of that runoff battle. But it turned out he could not overcome the cloud of questions around the corruption probe that's still ongoing, that has not implicated him, but has implicated members of his administration over his two terms in office. And he could not get over the negative poll, the negative ratings he had. Our poll and other polls showed that he had these consistently high negative ratings, in part due to his years of cutthroat politics in City Hall. And he couldn't withstand that. And we found that out ourselves when we were interviewing voters, not just yesterday, but over the course of the last few months, who, you know, said they were ready for a change in City Hall.
Andra?
I actually don't think that the polls got it wrong about Kasim Reed. If we look at sort of like where he's polling at about what the poll suggested that he was going to do. The big challenge in the surveys was that it was undecided who were leading the pack the entire time, and they stayed that way close to the end. And so given the high number of undecideds, given the number of people who said that they had an unfavorable view of Kasim Reed, and given the number of people who said that the corruption allegations about the Reed administration were a non-starter for them in terms of voting, what that 41% was a group that said, I'm not voting for Kasim Reed, but they weren't quite sure yet who they were voting for. And so what we found out was that Reed didn't really gain a whole lot of those votes, and that those votes really split more for Felicia Moore, but also in a substantial enough way for Andre Dickens. And Sharon Gay didn't benefit from any of that undecided largesse yesterday.
I think Andra's right. I think she's really right hitting the point here on those undecided, those people who waited until the very last moment to pick their candidate. And I think Dickens really scored well on that. People decided they liked his messaging. He went into a lot of the area that Reed had done well previously and was able to pick up those voters. But I looked back, and if you look at the race 4 years ago with Bottoms and that slate of 12 candidates then, that race was much more evenly divided, with 26% being the top vote getter. Norwood was only like 6 percentage points behind her. And this is a very different contest where you had Felicia Moore over 40%, which shows she really had a lot of backing throughout the city and ran a very, you know, positive, changing kind of messaging. And I think part of that we saw when she said that Atlanta deserves more. I think we're going to hear more of that over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah,
Donna?
I totally agree that he just couldn't overcome the negatives. And the least of them was the that he had people from his administration convicted of crimes. I think the NAACP rebuke was huge. I think that hit a lot of people. I remember someone calling me and saying, when the NAACP comes out against you, as a black person, how do you expect to make it? I think the quote that I saw from James Woodall, who was the former Georgia NAACP president and who's now with the Southern Center for Human Rights, he said, you can't expect to win an election and you trash the very people you need to win. I think that was huge. I think the People's Town flooding issues, that was a big deal. The accusations that he was forcing people out and using eminent domain. And I think the issues over the HBCUs in Atlanta and taking some of the land, you know, dealing with Morris Brown and Clark Atlanta University, those issues were big. So I think that he just, once those things started coming out in the last few weeks, I started seeing where people were really upset with him. So not unexpected.
Yeah, the NAACP, this was the Atlanta NAACP, which is, as we've discussed on the show, then was criticized by its own national organization for issuing what was essentially an anti-endorsement, I think is the best way to put that. But Andra, so did Stacey Abrams' organization issue a, I thought, surprising rebuke of Kasim Reed in the final week of the race.
Kasim Reed made a lot of enemies, and he hadn't really sort of, you know, been challenged by that, but this was his comeuppance. And we could see that coming, given the amount of money that he was raising, given his name recognition, given the infrastructure that we knew he was capable of putting together. The fact that he was only polling about 20% in the polls throughout this cycle was a sign that this was a challenged candidacy from the beginning. So even if he had made it into the primary, right, it was seriously doubtful given how well Andre Dickens performed that Dickens supporters, you know, who received the endorsement of Shirley Franklin, who has had a public falling out with Cassim Reed, were going to defect and support him in a runoff. And he's been in battle from the beginning. And even if he were to make it to the runoff election, this would still be a big, big challenge for him. So, I mean, I think that you know, this was a reckoning for him. And so we'll see, you know, what his career trajectory looks like after this.
Greg, because the Atlanta mayor's race really is significant around the state of Georgia, there are probably many people listening to this show who have no idea who Andre Dickens is. Who is Andre Dickens? And what does it mean that, yeah, there are people in Atlanta, I know that as well, but who is he and what might it mean that he is now probably in the runoff?
Yeah, he is a successful businessman and a councilman in the city of Atlanta who's always seen as sort of one of the members of the ascendant, younger, more progressive political class in Atlanta. He didn't go as far left in this race as people like a Councilman Antonio Brown, who gained very little traction. But he also presented a muscular approach to fighting crime and to preventing the Buckhead split, maybe the two biggest issues on the tops of the minds of a lot of Atlanta voters. But also, he spoke to the issue that was on the top of the mind of a lot of the younger Atlanta voters, which was housing inequality. And he had plans to help bring more affordable housing to the city and help bridge that gap between the income diversity in Atlanta.
Andre, we do think that turnout was pretty low. It'll be interesting to see what the final numbers are and what that might mean for the runoff, whether people are going to suddenly get energized to want to turn out. But let me ask you, if I may, a different question. In two victories in which Kasim Reed was elected mayor, he won against Mary Norwood, a white candidate, by less than 1,000 votes in each case. Should we here in the city of Atlanta, and really for that matter across the state, be heartened by the fact that it appeared that race played almost no role in this race, to the extent that Sharon Gay, the white candidate in the race, really, unfortunately for her, never gained any traction? Is there some sign of progress in that, Andre?
Well, you know, I think that it is important for us to not caricature votes solely on the basis of race, and to understand, sure, in particular for African-American voters, because they're the ones that are really kind of determining who's making it to the runoff here, are sophisticated and that they make very nuanced decisions. There is still, there is still racial polarization in this election. So if you look at the map, we know what residential segregation looks like in the city of Atlanta. Alicia Moore is doing well in the parts of town that Mary Norwood won. Cassine Reed, and she was dominant there. I mean, it wasn't that she, you know, just won. It was that she dominated. Like, if this race had just been north of North Avenue, Felicia Moore would have won last night. Kasim Reed won pluralities in the south side of the city. Moore and Dickens kind of were strong second and third place contenders, which is why he's in third place position at this point. And we see places where Dickens was doing well in Midtown and parts of East Atlanta and in other places. So we still see that whites have a strong preference for one candidate. That is likely going to put Felicia Moore in really strong contention going into the runoff election. I think that if, you know, Reed were the second place finisher, I think we would probably see some type of racially polarized voting, but he would underperform in black areas in part because his negatives are high. I think what's going to be really interesting if Dickens actually turns out to be the second place finisher, which, you know, is very likely at this point, who his coalition is. And in terms of thinking about what the coalitions look like, when I think of this for Kasim Reed, he kind of is in the same position that Lisa Borders was in, a little different, but a different type of position, but a similar position that Lisa Borders in 2009 in terms of not having a clear constituency. So, yeah, he's doing better in the black parts of town, but the other black candidates held their own there as well. So it's not like he had a monopoly on that support in the same way that he did in 2009 when he was able to beat Borders.
Okay, Donna, I don't want to push a point that may not be pertinent, but what I also heard Andra just say is that Felicia Moore did pretty well with the kind of white voters who, when Mary Norwood was on the ballot, would have voted, had voted for her. So I'm just wondering if we can say that there's any progress in white voters' willingness to turn to black candidates when in the past they would have gone with a white candidate in this race, if the Norwood candidacy was any indication.
No, I totally agree that I think that that's what's happening, that they didn't necessarily have to have a white candidate for the voters who would go for a white candidate, for white voters to go for someone like Felicia Moore. I heard a lot of people talk about the positives with her, and some of that with the white community, the people that I know, was a negative to read to go for Felicia Moore early on. I think, and in terms of Andre Dickens, I think it's going to take a while. It's going to be interesting to see where his coalition builds and how much he's able to pull from the Sharon Gay people, some of the others. You know, remember, there were 14 people in this race, some of the others, and pull that together. I think if he is the one who's going to be going up against Felicia Moore, he's got to do some work there in terms of people understanding who he really is.
Thank you for that. Look, I'm not suggesting we've reached some kumbaya moment. We certainly are a long way from doing that, unfortunately, but I do find some interest in how the vote turned out yesterday. Greg, let's look at a couple other races in Metro particularly. There were people who thought that progressive challengers to incumbents might gain some traction in this election. So, for instance, in Sandy Springs, Dante Carter, an African-American Democrat, challenged Rusty Paul, the incumbent, and there were people who wondered if he could gain any traction. Well, it doesn't appear he did. Rusty Paul is winning by a huge margin. I mean, you think he had something like 70% of the vote as of early this morning. So Rusty Paul will serve another term as mayor of Sandy Springs. In Tucker, a little town of Tucker in DeKalb County, the incumbent mayor, Frank Ellman, was challenged by a Democrat named Robin Abrio. He beat her pretty handily. More important, up in Marietta, Steve Tomlin, who was identified as a Republican, also won against a Democrat. So, I mean, it looks like this notion that there's going to be some progressive insurgency that's going to sweep through cities in the state certainly didn't develop last night.
Yeah, I mean, Democrats were really excited about these opportunities to run these down-ticket, technically nonpartisan races, but the three people you just mentioned are all closely aligned with Republican politics. Steve Tomlin's a former Republican state lawmaker. Rusty Paul's a former Georgia GOP chair. Frank Ahman is a former Republican operative. So Democrats were hoping to pull off what they pulled off in the last two election cycles, which is running down ticket in these state legislative races that were rarely challenged by Democrats in these, you know, safely Republican seats. They were hoping to build a bench with these mayoral races now too. And in many of the cases, we're not sure about all because we're still seeing some of the results, but in many of these cases, the Democratic challengers, who often kind of wore their party affiliation on their sleeves, were defeated by the incumbents or by the conservative-leaning challengers.
Karen?
Yeah, and so in these local elections, I think we see clearly one point, which is the incumbents have an advantage. People know them. Their name ID is usually higher. And in these low turnout local elections, people gravitate back to the person's name that they know usually. You know, Greg mentioned that these have become partisan, but also these are people running, you know, and trying to get their neighbors' votes. And so sometimes they are not always looking at the shifting winds of the partisan politics. I would also say that some of these elections we've looked at, you know, the idea that the suburbs of Atlanta are now really moving blue and are Democratic, I think we may want to hold off and say, hey, wait a minute, maybe the Democrats have rented those suburbs in 18 and 20, but they don't own them yet, right? Like in 2021, we're seeing some movement back that the independents are trying to pick someone, and they may not own it for a few more election cycles.
You know, I think that that's an important point, that we should be braced for competitive elections for the next few cycles going forward. And I think, you know, before, you know, the candidates who lost, I think that as these suburbs become increasingly diverse, it should become normal for there to be candidates of color. And it should also be normal that you're going to see folks who are more liberal than the type of candidates who would have been running in these areas 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, depending on when they were incorporated.
Okay, let's move on to one last issue in terms of local elections, Donna. There were any number of e-splosts on the ballot yesterday. Voters were asked in a number of counties if they would either extend or begin a penny sales tax that would be used for education. And I think it's a sign that people in the state, to some extent, really do see the value of education, because from what I'm seeing in the returns, many of those e-splosts, in fact, succeeded. I was interested in the fact that in my own polling place in DeKalb County, that was the only item on the ballot, one item. Would the county extend the one penny sales tax to be used for capital improvements at the schools? And I was really kind of surprised at how many people were at my polling place for that one issue when I showed up.
Yeah, it just shows you also that what this pandemic has done. It's made people focus more on schools and understand what's going on in classrooms and the needs that are in those classrooms that are so important. And also we saw more people involved because of the pandemic issues in terms of what was going on with local school boards in terms of things like the mask mandates and vaccines and all of that. And so I think people are paying more attention to schools, and this can only bode well in terms of the school districts feeling like they can go ahead with some capital improvements and do some things that they need to do. One of the things we know with an e-splos is you can use that money to help with tech issues. And that, we know, was a big issue during the pandemic, making sure these kids could actually get into the classrooms virtually.
Well said by the woman who was, without doubt, the best known and most highly respected education reporter during her years at Channel 11 in Atlanta. Greg, take us to the break. What final thoughts do you have about the local elections that you watched unfold?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you see a dismal turnout in many of these, but as Donna said, there was still local enthusiasm over issues that were near and dear to people's hearts, and it was a test case for Georgia's new election law. We saw that there were some minor glitches, but for the most part, things went fairly smoothly, which was a benefit. I think it was good for voters, no matter how you feel about the election law, to get used to the new regime.
Yeah, I want to quickly say that we had a panelist on the show yesterday who said that when he went to vote, it took longer. There were barriers to voting. And I'm not sure I understood that, because when I voted yesterday, the process was faster than it's ever been before. Now, granted, it was a low turnout election, but at the very beginning of it, I'd never had to fill out the kind of form that I have in the past. Everything was in the computer, so all I had to do was hand in my driver's license. So at least my experience yesterday was there are a few things about this that worked very smoothly, which is not to say everything about SB 202 is guaranteed to make elections operate the way most people would like to see democracy work in this state. All right, let's do this. Let's get to our first break in the show, because we really want to talk about Virginia. A huge win for Republicans yesterday. But how much impact do we really think it has on a state like Georgia? We'll talk about that and more after these messages. Donna Lowry, Karen Owen, Greg Bluestein, and Andra Gillespie on today's Political Rewind. Andra, I'm so glad you're with us the day after the Virginia election. You grew up in Virginia. You know the state politically inside and out. And so I'm really eager to hear your take on this. It seemed, I think, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong, in the final days of the race, it felt increasingly like Terry McAuliffe was not headed for victory. The polls showed it neck and neck, but McAuliffe actually sent a letter out to his supporters yesterday before the results were in saying, win or lose, we fought the good fight, which is never a good sign for a candidate. And then as the results started coming in, and in areas of the state where Joe Biden had done so well in 2020, McAuliffe was underperforming him significantly. It was not surprising that Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, is becoming the first Republican governor in 12 years in Virginia, right?
Yeah, so I'm going to do a little bit of comparison to New Jersey, and I can do New Jersey privileges because I have a New Jersey birth certificate and wrote my first book about Newark. So spent a lot of time there, too. When I looked at both maps, and, you know, New Jersey's race is still too close to call, and you start to look at where the outstanding votes were. Last night, when people are noticing how close the race is between Phil Murphy and Chitterelli, and you're looking at the numbers and you're like, there's a lot of outstanding votes in Passaic and Essex and Hudson counties. You're like, that's Jersey City, that's Newark, that's Patterson and Passaic. All right, like those are Democratic areas. And so it's narrower than people expected, but one would expect that Phil Murphy's probably going to win. Last night when I started to look at the numbers, one of the first places that I looked was the Fairfax County vote was kind of in. The Prince William vote was largely in. The outstanding votes were in Chesterfield, south of Richmond. And it was like, there aren't enough votes in Chesterfield County for Terry McAuliffe to be able to pull off this victory. So between that and having played math with the exit polls to try to figure out what the exit polls were predicting, it was like, you know, I knew pretty early that this was likely going to go in Youngkin's favor. You know, Youngkin was able to capitalize on social issues, and he was able to tap into the anger of the electorate over those issues in ways that resonates with me with work that my friend Davin Phoenix has done at the University of California, Irvine, that talks about anger and how anger is actually a mobilizing factor in white voter turnout. That's what it looks like is happening here. And there also seems to be a failure of mobilization and turnout. African Americans turned out at rates, it looks like, that are lower than what their proportion of the population would suggest that they would be. That's damaging for Democrats. And so it seems like all of this attention that was focused on Northern Virginia because it's populist, right, came at the expense perhaps of looking at African American voters, not just in Northern Virginia, but also in Richmond and in Tidewater. So everybody's comparing it to last year. I've been looking at the 2017 numbers and looking at the places that Ralph Northam won. Ralph Northam won Virginia Beach. Virginia Beach went Youngkin this time. Out in the western part of the state, Northam won Montgomery County, which is where Blacksburg, Virginia Tech is, right? Youngkin won that this time around. So, you know, it looks like Youngkin won Chesapeake. There are these places that Democrats should do better in that he didn't do better in. And Northam was in a unique position. He was a state senator who represented Tidewater, was a doctor in the Norfolk area, was from the eastern shore of Virginia. And McAuliffe never had that. But I think probably at the end of the day, I've got to look at this a little bit more. But one of the things that I'm also sort of looking at in the data preliminarily is the reaction to his comment that parents, you know, shouldn't be allowed to dictate what their kids are taught in school was this unforced error that was the gift that kept on giving for Glenn Youngkin. And the reaction to a loss of parental control tied in with the racial resentment that's somewhat underlying it, because people were arguing about whether or not you should teach Beloved in school and critical race theory, is something that we're going to be spending a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah, Karen, weigh in on this, if you will, please. What one of the things you noticed, Andra mentioned the African American vote underperforming, but you also looked at the vote of white women as expressed in the exit polls, and those are voters who in 2020 almost certainly were voting for Joe Biden in the state of Virginia, helped him win Virginia, and certainly they were voting for Joe Biden here in Georgia as well. What happened in Virginia with those white female voters?
So you're right. So part of my interest in this race was what did happen, and especially those white women in suburbs. And it looks like through exit polling that they went to Youngkin 57-43, which is a significant swing from what their support to Biden had been, which I think is a roughly maybe about 16-point swing away from the Democrats. And I think that we could probably speculate, and I'm like, Andre, you really need to look at some of these exit polling and what the white women specifically were talking about. But two issues really resonate with these women, and one is the economy, and two is education, because most of them do have children, and they're very concerned about what their children have experienced in the last 2 years in terms of the COVID pandemic, what has happened with schools being, you know, shut down and virtual learning and then going back, as well as that Republicans ran on the issue. When McAuliffe made the statement, they jumped on that to really excite a base to come out and vote and support them, with the idea that Youngkin's talking a lot now about school choice, which again would resonate a lot with some of these female voters. And I think we cannot escape the fact or ignore the fact that Joe Biden's approval rating is extremely low right now. It is lower right now than at this stage of his presidency than any other presidents really in the modern era when we've looked at polling. And that has played, I think, a really critical factor. The Democrats could not run on a, look how we have governed, look what we were doing for you. They didn't have that messaging in this race.
So, Greg, some of the lessons for Georgia, and then we can keep talking about this. As both Karen and Andra said, the education issue was really Youngkin's strong suit in his closing. I think something like 75-80% of his ads in the final weeks of the race mentioned Terry McAuliffe saying parents shouldn't tell teachers what they can teach. The question becomes, this is something that I would think Georgia Republicans are going to run with moving into 2022 in a very strong way. And Virginia gives them hope that it's a message that might resonate.
Yeah, look, we're already seeing that. I mean, Burt Jones, the lieutenant governor candidate, came out right before the election on Monday with an ad focusing on critical race theory. Brian Kemp, we saw months ago, take this issue. And if you're Brian Kemp, you're watching. He's in a very different position than Glenn Youngkin because Donald Trump is openly going out, criticizing him and promising to support his opponent. But still, if you're Brian Kemp, you're looking at Glenn Youngkin's path to victory and realizing that you could focus on critical race theory, on immigration, on education-related issues that are hot-button culture wars, and you know, and have a path to victory. Stacey Abrams, about what lessons it has for Democrats or potential Democratic candidates like Stacey Abrams, it's harder to draw that line because Terry McAuliffe had to bring in Stacey Abrams and Keisha Lance Bottoms to help energize the African-American vote. I'm not surprising by telling you Stacey Abrams has no problem doing that. She already is energizing the African-American vote, so she won't need extra support to try to mobilize black voters. That is her calling card. That is what she's been able to do effectively in 2018 and in building her political organization since then.
Donna, I think that Greg just said something really important, and I'd love for you, Andra, and Karen to pick up on it. I mean, there are some things that Republicans here and Democrats will learn out of Virginia. But the fact of the matter is, number one, Terry McAuliffe was a very imperfect candidate who did not run a particularly strong campaign. So that's one strike against him. Number two, he ran his campaign without a lot of ideas of what he wanted to do. He ran an anti-Trump campaign. Glenn Youngkin was able to counter that by being very careful about only talking about Trump on the most conservative media outlets and distancing himself from Trump in other circumstances. So, I mean, there are things that are not going to be similar, Donna. But again, going back to your strong suit, education, it's looking more and more like could be one of the most important issues we'll talk about in 2022.
Yeah. And as somebody who's been covering education for a long time, it's good to see that people are caring about it. And I go back to saying that the pandemic changed everything. Remember, the whole issue of critical race theory came out during the pandemic, when parents were paying more attention to exactly what was happening in schools, how school boards were handling the pandemic-related issues. And now, and then this comes out of nowhere after 40-something years, a theory, and people have, it really energized them. It gave them something to really think about. And Youngkin understood how important that was going to be in putting him over the line, because he really, really dug deep into it, as I understand, near the end of the campaign. And it appears to have worked well for him.
Andra?
You know, one of the things I would caution in terms of the comparisons between the states is there are more white Democrats in Virginia than there are, you know, in Georgia. So, like, it was never an apples-to-apples comparison to begin with. While I expect that certain tropes like critical race theory, defund the police, law and order, tax and spend liberals, socialists, all of those things, tropes that Republicans have been using for the last couple of years are going to, you know, still be used in 2022 as part of the nationalization of our politics. We also have to remember and cannot forget that the candidates themselves matter. And this has somewhat been alluded to already. One of the things that I forgot to say sort of a couple minutes ago was that if you look at McAuliffe's performance and his vote totals, you usually expect that you're going to lose votes as you start to go downstream. And that actually wasn't the case this time around. So if you look at his running mates, running for lieutenant governor, running for attorney general, they actually got more votes than he did, which suggests that there were people who were just frustrated with him as a candidate and they didn't like him. And even though they all lost sort of in this wave of anti-democratic sentiment, Terry McAuliffe was a drag at the top of the ticket. And so that's something that they're going to have to reflect and own as they try to figure out what happened here.
Yeah, Greg, it appears as of this hour, as we do this show live in the morning, that the Virginia House of Delegates, which has been a Democratic-controlled body, is going to flip and be controlled by Republicans going forward. That's another bad sign for Democrats.
A major shift, a major sign for down-ticket races. Again, it's hard to read into these. A lot can happen in the next year. And look, you know, speaking of McAuliffe's strategy, it was so muddied, as everyone has said. And it was so focused on Trump near the end. I mean, I think he said in his election rally, he said Trump's name 13 times in a very short speech. This is something we also have not seen Stacey Abrams do. In 2018, it was a different time, but in 2018, she would barely mention even Trump's name. She would talk about the man in the White House. Instead, she would focus on state issues, education, taxes, the economy, healthcare. So if she runs, which is still widely expected in the Democratic world here, you know, it's hard to draw that parallel between her and McAuliffe, because she'll probably bring up Trump, I'm sure, but she will not focus her campaign, especially in the fall, in the final days, on Trump-related issues, especially when it's such a close, narrow race in general and statewide.
So, Karen, so let me ask you about this in terms of Trump. We saw Youngkin distance himself as much as possible from Trump, and it apparently helped him with some of the voters you talked about, white women voters especially. That's not a comparison to Georgia, at least in the primary campaigns. Republican candidates on the ballot in Georgia are hugging as tightly to Trump, with a few exceptions, as they possibly can. So they're not learning any lesson from the way Youngkin performed in Virginia. But is it going to have an impact on how they then try to recalculate what happens if they win their primaries and move to a general election? I don't see how they pivot and suddenly decide to distance themselves.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, that even as we sit here postmortem, Trump has still been very active in Georgia politics versus his activism in Virginia politics. I think that's been different because he still feels very bruised that he lost the state of Georgia. So I think that the primary candidates here in Georgia, a lot of them are, you know, have the endorsement of Trump. They're going to be paying attention to those Trump voters. And I think Greg's point about the Democratic candidates, how much will they actually bring up Trump's name when we get into the general, or will they stay out of that because they don't want to energize that base of voters to turn out in the general election and vote for the Republican, even if it's not a Trump-backed person like him, but just mobilizing them instead of pivoting to their own base and trying to mobilize that base as well. And I would say that, you know, one thing out of Virginia that I think the Georgia Republicans, you know, they can pay attention to the House of Delegates potentially flipping. But two, to Andre's point about down ticket and those constitutional offices in Virginia for the lieutenant governor and attorney general, let's not lose the fact that the first black woman was elected lieutenant governor in Virginia and is a Republican. Yeah. And the first Latino attorney general was elected, who is a Republican. So Republicans in Georgia need to say, hey, we can tap into diversity. It can win. We can win with this. It's been seen in Virginia. It could probably work here. And it's not an apple-to-apples comparison, but I think they need to look at their bench a little bit more clearly.
Okay, we got to get to break, but that is such an important point, except, Andra, that Republicans in Georgia can't do that as long as they are so tied to Donald Trump.
Well, they think they're doing it with Herschel Walker if he ends up winning the nomination. So that's where they think they're doing it.
Do you think they're doing that with Herschel Walker?
No. And I mean, and I think in Virginia, I think we also kind of have to be careful sort of about thinking of, I think Winston Sears in particular, the lieutenant governor-elect, is somebody who's a very interesting character. She will speak truth to power on obvious forms of racism, but it's a question of the subtle stuff. It's a question of the systemic stuff that I think is still a really, really big problem that the party has writ large and even their candidates of color.
Got to get to the final break of the show. Last remark. Whatever it means to the state of Georgia, Democrats across the country are terrified about what might happen to the United States House of Representatives and the Senate next year, and they're going to have to start thinking about how they recalibrate if they expect to win some of the key races next year. And we'll be talking a lot about that on Political Rewind in the weeks ahead. Let's get to our final break. When we come back, the redistricting session is underway at the state capitol. We'll talk about that coming up. Donna Lowry, you are down to the Capitol. You're going to be watching redistricting, and every night at 7 are going to be giving us reports from down there, brief reports about how things are going. The radio is the worst medium possible for trying to really talk about maps and get into a lot of data. Let me just read you Stephen Fowler's lead, which has posted his story on the maps that have so far been thrown around. It's posted on the GPB News website. There are practically infinite ways to redraw the boundaries for Georgia state and congressional legislative districts. Only a few will be up for debate in the special session. After the 2020 census documented explosive population growth in metropolitan areas and the 2020 election cemented a purple political shift, the General Assembly will be tasked with crafting new district lines that will last for a decade. He then goes on to talk about the influx of Black, Hispanic, Asian residents in Metro and the loss of population in rural Georgia. All of that is fascinating, but Republicans control the redistricting process, and they will certainly draw lines and have the votes to pass maps that will benefit them without regard, or maybe with just minimum regard, to the growth in minority communities, especially in Metro.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people aren't following Stephen on this, they should be, because Stephen is doing such a good job at looking at these maps and taking and translating them. But yeah, it is. We know in the end that it is the Republicans are in control, and they will be the ones that we will be looking to make the difference. Yesterday, the Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan and the Senate Majority Caucus released their draft of the Senate map from the Senate Redistricting and Reapportionment Committee. We haven't had a chance to really look at it, but we'll see a lot of back and forth down here. And the Democrats are going to do what they can to make changes, but in the end, it'll all be on the Republicans. One of the interesting things that I've heard from Democrats is that their big thing is right now lawsuits. That they whatever happens, they're going to sue. That always happens. It happened certainly in 2001, and that changed things from the Democratic-controlled legislature to finding out that they had to change things and have a special session for after the Republicans filed the lawsuit. So, you know, this is a long process to try to explain that to everybody is difficult, but I think it's interesting given the changing demographics in this state and the slide we've seen from rural areas in terms of population into the bigger cities.
Greg, we've already seen at least one map, and it appears Republicans are going to work toward this in the congressional districts. that will put Lucy McBath in jeopardy in the sixth and may solidify Carolyn Bordeaux's hold on the seventh. But the sixth, they're looking to make perhaps a Republican district, yeah?
Yeah, Republicans have a major challenge. Even though they're in control, they're trying to preserve their majorities while also dealing with declining populations in rural-leaning areas, in rural areas where Republicans thrive. And so you're seeing that with congressional districts. Ideally, they'd want to draw both Lucy McBath and Carolyn Bordeaux into more competitive districts. But if you do both, if you even try to do both of them, beyond the legal challenges, you could end up risking both those seats down the line further into the decade. So it looks like they're just going to go after one, probably Lucy McBath. And then when you look at the state Senate and the state House maps, they're trying to preserve pretty hefty majorities while also folding in these rural districts. And so in the state Senate map, you see two Republican-held districts completely collapse. Both of them are held by Republicans running for statewide seats, Tyler Harper and Bruce Thompson. And in the state House, you're seeing Republicans draw fellow Republicans into primary challenges, which will probably lead to resignations and such. People might be ready to get appointments or ready to move out of office anyway. But you're seeing Republicans have to make very tough decisions within their own caucus and at the same time try to draw Democratic incumbents in competitive metro Atlanta areas into tougher fields. You saw that in North Metro in particular, in Cobb County and in sort of North Fulton County. You see some Democratic incumbents who will face very tough reelection chances now.
Karen?
You know, the state legislators, these Republicans, they know that the demographic shifts have changed. They can't ignore it. Then they're having to play within the legal bounds. I mean, they are constrained by equal population and the Voting Rights Act, and they know that. And they've also were on the minority set in 2001 when the Democrats were trying to, for 10 years, hold theirs, advantage. So I think they're coming into this with all that, and you'll see that shift from rural Georgia to metro Atlanta. And I think what's interesting is these maps that are being released, they're really focusing in on Gwinnett County and Forsyth. It's to me like they say, okay, yep, we got to put another Senate district in Gwinnett because that's where the Democrats have control. Population has really been changing. And so we're going to let maybe that one go. And then Forsyth, they're seeing, which is a Republican area, but shoring up, how do you keep that? How do you bring in some of those voters for the House district to maintain it? I think that will be interesting to play out, as well as if we talk about, I really want to get this done because women matter. Women in politics matter. And during redistricting, female incumbents are not protected. And we will see that in the South Georgia realm, a newly elected woman will be paired her district with other members, Lucy McBath, Carolyn Bordeaux. These are women too that, even though they're of the other party, but, we'll see this nationwide where these female incumbents get paired, their districts get changed, they lose their core voters, and so they get impacted in this redistricting cycle.
Andre, I'm really glad Karen points that out because we don't hear enough about exactly how women fare in the processes. But we should, of course, always remember that this is the first redistricting that we will go through without preclearance by DOJ. It will have to be after the fact.
Yes. And, it's important to keep in mind that there are parts of Section 2 that are still operable here and that might actually, be able to be influenced. So, what I have heard, the chatter seems to suggest that if Sanford Bishop's district gets drawn in some really funny ways to try to dilute the power of African-American voters in the district, that would be the one that's actually more likely to be subjected to change. It's going to be harder to make a claim of packing just because of the diversity of Carolyn Bordeaux's district, but I think that Republicans think they have some cover by moving some voters of color over into Bordeaux's district and making that a little bit more Democratic so that they might sort of be absolved of any claims of racism in terms of disadvantaging Lucy McBath.
We've got about 2 minutes, but before we do anything else, tell our listeners what you mean when you talk about packing. Give us about a 25-second definition of what that means, because it's important to the process.
Right. So you only need 50% plus one of, any group of voters to, be able to guarantee victory. And so if you make a district 90% Democratic, that's packing them in a district. Some of those Democratic voters could go into another district to make it competitive. From a race standpoint, if you make a district, 80% African-American or 70% Latino, like, you don't need that many voters of color to guarantee that they're going to pick a candidate of their choice. That, especially if it's the primary reason that you're doing it, is unconstitutional. And so that's where challenges come from.
And because you're diluting their strength across a number of districts is what makes it really pernicious.
Right. So when those districts become overwhelmingly Democratic, the adjacent districts become more Republican and whiter as well, just given our racial politics.
I just, as we move through this process, I think it's really important that we make sure our listeners are with us as we talk about these things. We are way, way out of time after a wonderful conversation with you, Andrew Gillespie. Donna Lowry, good luck down to the Capitol. We'll be watching you on GPB TV. Karen Owen, thank you. And Greg Bluestein, one more time, congratulations to our Atlanta Braves. Thank you all for being with us. We're back with another show again tomorrow. I'm Bill Nygut. Remember, take care, stay healthy. Yes, wear your mask around other people. Get the booster shot if you're eligible for it. It's easily available. And get your flu shot, too. See you all tomorrow.